When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Finding the right news podcast can feel like dating. It seems promising until you start listening.
When you hit play on Post Reports, you'll get fascinating conversations and sometimes a little fun, too. I'm Martine Powers.
And I'm Elahe Azadi. Martine and I are the hosts of Post Reports. The show comes out every weekday from The Washington Post.
You can follow and listen to Post Reports wherever you get your podcasts. It'll be a match, I promise.
With dozens of streaming services, box office films, and content to choose from, people are spending over 2.5 years of their lives searching for what to watch. But The Hollywood Reporter brings you THR Charts, one place for you, your family, and friends to find the most watched TV shows and movies every week. THR Charts is a guide to help you spend less time scrolling through platforms so that you can spend more time watching and binging the content everyone is talking about, all supported by data and trusted sources like Nielsen, Comscore, and Paired Analytics. Check out THR Charts on HollywoodReporter.com.
Hi, I'm Ethan Nadelman, and this is Psychoactive, a production of iHeartRadio and Protozoa Pictures. Psychoactive is the show where we talk about all things drugs. But any views expressed here do not represent those of iHeartMedia, Protozoa Pictures, or their executives and employees. Indeed, as an inveterate contrarian, I can tell you they may not even represent my own. And nothing contained in this show should be used as medical advice or encouragement to use any type of drugs. Hello, psychoactive listeners. You know, I thought as we're coming to the end of season two of Psychoactive and not knowing really for sure what lies up ahead, I was thinking about the sort of folks I'd most want to have on before we conclude the second season. And one of those is my friend Paul Gutenberg. He is probably one of the two leading deans of drug history studies. Paul has been, he's been a professor at SUNY, State University of New York at Stony Brook for many, many years. He's just a former Rhodes Scholar. He started off his historical stuff writing about bird shit, aka guano, and the commerce in guano. But he moved from there into the field of coca studies, coca and cocaine, roughly 30 years ago. He wrote a book that might be regarded as kind of a biography of coca and cocaine, but he's now currently chairing the Association of the Drug and Alcohol Historians Society. He recently edited a 700-page edited volume of the Oxford Handbook of Global Drug History. He just helped organize a meeting in Mexico City where I was at last June. It was one of my first encounters with this broader world. So, Paul, I want to thank you ever so much for joining me and my listeners on Psychoactive.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Ethan.
So let me just say, just also speaking personally, I realize I've been looking back at the episodes of Psychoactive, and quite a number have been on history. Some have been on different drugs like alcohol or kava. Some have been about history in certain countries like Iran or Mexico. Some have been about more, middle 20th century histories like on drugs and jazz or the narcotic farms that that Nancy Campbell talked about. So history really is a kind of favorite of mine. And my true confessions here, when I was 8 years old, I told people what I wanted to be when I grew up was a history professor. So for me, looking at the history of drugs, even though it may feel kind of obscure to many people, just seems incredibly rich. And it's part of why I felt such a kinship with you over all these, years and even decades. So let me just start off by asking this basic question. When you made that evolution, right, 30-odd years ago from your early work on guano to looking at coca, what was it that stimulated you? Was it the commodities market element of this, or was there something bigger than that? Or did you have your own personal reason, as I did in some respects, for being interested in psychoactive drugs?
To some extent, there was a personal issue in the sense that maybe a little bit more than yourself. I was a, you know, child of the 60s. So when I was growing up, the issues and the questions around illicit drugs were very much in the air, and kind of resurfaced with me in the 1990s as I began to search around for new topics of investigation. But how I fell into drugs was quite easy at the time, which was I had been kind of proven my way as a economic historian of the Andes, University of Chicago pedigree, all the stuff, interdisciplinarity. And I was looking for a new topic to work on. And this was in the early 90s. And a friend of mine who had been working as a journalist in the Andes said that they'd been working. This was the contemporary explosion of cocaine in the Amazon Andes at that time in the Huallaga Valley. And she told me there's really nothing written about the history of this stuff. This might be interesting to you. And so, you know, I started poking around, and lo and behold, it really was interesting. It was interesting because it was a whole new unknown where if you had, new archival work to do and new facts to establish and new perspectives to bring in, there was just a tremendously open field. And it was exciting in a way because, you know, drugs are, let's face it, they're an exciting and sexy topic. And they have a lot of repercussions for how we think about the world today. And contrary to what maybe a lot of people think about historians, most historians are motivated by questions that are in the zeitgeist today. And by the 1990s, the, you know, global drug regimes and the failures, the violence, the scope, the global scope of a drug like cocaine was pretty much everywhere. So I began to be interested in his origins. But I do want to say one other thing, which is what particularly attracted me to doing drug history. And there were a few already established figures in the field, like David Corbright, or Musto, people we could talk about. What really fascinated me about this was all the learning that you could do, because it is so cross-disciplinary. There's so much trespassing to be had in studying something like drugs, because, I mean, as you alluded to, there's this very strong kind of traditional anthropological interest in shamanism and drugs and taboos and non-taboo substances. There was commodity studies, which was something I was familiar with, but there was a rising new variety of commodity studies about the social constructions and the meanings that objects and substances have. There's medical history and the history of medicine, which was at that time beginning to take a more critical turn than it had in the past. That is looking at medicine and its products as an object rather than a methodology in history. And just across the board, sociologists, political scientists like yourself, legal scholars, so many different angles to draw on in thinking about this issue of, you know, where do our contemporary entanglements with drugs come from? And even basic questions that continue to, I wouldn't say plague the field, but animate the field, which is what are drugs? And so the important work here in the United States by Courtright was in 2001, which was published by Harvard University Press, which was Forces of Habit, Drugs and the Making of the Modern World. And
that's where he coins the term the psychoactive revolution, right?
The psychoactive revolution. And in many ways, Courtright's book there, his synthesis there, is to take a global view and a long historical view of many, many drugs and drug-like substances and follow them through centuries and waves of origins and consumption and try to trace out what is the big question in drug history. Why do certain drugs spread globally? Why do certain drugs become legitimized? Why do certain drugs become illegitimized and then criminalized? So he was asking huge questions. And the most interesting way is the way it begins with this notion of the psychoactive revolution. And basically what Courtright proposes, and I think is something that really animated this larger community of people who work on drugs, which is hundreds of historians today, is that drugs were actually quite important in the constitution of modernity as we think of it today. Starting in the 16th century, all types of stimulants began to flow together and reach first Europeans and then Middle Easterners and Asians and North Americans, and they began to be part of our kind of integral lifestyles, everything from coffee to tobacco, and then later things like, you know, Coca-Cola or opiates or...
Or for that matter, right, cacao becoming chocolate, right?
Cacao
or
becoming chocolate.
For that matter. And one can even look at sugar in some respects as one of them, right?
Right. And the work on sugar that was very important in kind of also shaping the history of drugs was Sidney Mintz's Sweetness and Power, which gave, I don't know if you've read that, but it's a historical anthropology of sugar around the same period, which really set the stage for global thinking about how consumption regimes and political regimes are closely related. And sucrose was in many ways treated as a drug in Sidney Mintz's terms. But Courtwright's book, the notion of the psychoactive revolution, the notion of asking deep historical questions about why drugs spread, why some drugs don't spread, why they become legitimate by state-building processes later by the 18th and 19th centuries, why is rum part of the British Empire, why does cannabis never reach that kind of state nexus. He was asking big questions and giving well-founded historical answers to them. Are they all correct? Do I agree with them all? No. But he was opening, you know, the big canvas on doing serious drug history. And I still think it remains one of the best books that anyone's interested in kind of the history of drugs can look at.
Well, you know, Paul, you're reminding me here, right, is that probably the article I wrote in my professorial days in the late 80s, early 90s, they garnered the greatest sort of respect. And maybe not actually at the time, it's more had long legs over the last few decades, was a piece I wrote called Global Prohibition Regimes, subtitled The Evolution of Norms in International Society. And I wrote that in the late 1980s. And what drove it was even stepping even one step further back than Courtwright. It was asking the question, two questions really. One was, how and why is it that certain activities that at some point in history are regarded as entirely legal, or at least not illegal all around the world, subsequently become criminalized throughout the world, and not just criminalized throughout the world, but become the subject of what I coined global prohibition regimes. And so when I start off with drugs and look backwards and forwards, and looking backwards, the first one that hit me was basically, you know, piracy and privateering. Right, which at one point are, you know, privateering is essentially licensed legal piracy. And at some point, they become the subject of the first kind of global prohibition regime. The second one was the prohibition of the global trade, the global slave trade, and then slavery itself, right, which really emerges in the late, you know, the 18th century, then obviously well into the 19th century, with the United States being one of the last of major countries to ban slavery, at least in the Western world. Right. And then it's followed by a kind of aborted efforts to have an alcohol prohibition regime, a prohibition regime directed at white slavery, which was the term for prostitution and the movement of women for purposes of prostitution across borders. And then I jumped it forward to the emerging regimes, global regimes, that banning the killing of elephants and whales and intelligent species, as well as other types of activities. And then the second question I asked was, why is it that some of these global prohibition regimes, you know, result in basically almost abolishing or eliminating the activity at which they were targeted, whereas others utterly fail? So, for example, the prohibition regimes directed at piracy more or less becomes largely successful, except for little pockets of piracy, you know, around, you know, parts of Asia or Africa. The regime criminalizing, prohibiting slavery and the slave trade also becomes largely successful, whereas the one against drugs, you know, utterly fails, right? Where you have a bigger markets probably existing per capita after the institution of the global prohibition regime than before. Now, one of my main arguments there was that moral factors. It's not just all about economics and security and politics, that there was actually a transnational moral dimension. And I argue that, in fact, they played very important roles, that there was a moralizing, paternalizing element to what happened in all of these regimes that cannot be discounted. And then the question about why drugs failed, I mean, part of that had to do with how susceptible the activities were to suppression, right? That ultimately, you know, the emergence of steamboats, and some other factors makes piracy much less viable. You know, other factors with slavery I won't go into, but that with drugs, you know, these things were so easily trafficked and so easily in such small amounts that it was no way to essentially suppress all of this. But I also looked at the question of technological developments, right? So, for example, the emergence of the hypodermic syringe in the middle of the 19th century transforms the notion of taking opioids, for example, the emergence of morphine, the emergence of cocaine being taken in those ways. In a very different way, the emergence of the cigarette rolling machine, I think in the early 20th century, transforms the nature of tobacco consumption around the world. And so when we look across the board, I sometimes wonder, like if you look at cocaine versus coffee, how much did their different evolutions have to do with the potential of those substances to be synthesized into something much more potent? For example, the fact that coffee, you know, never emerges as, you know, caffeine and taking in it, it never becomes an injectable or snortable drug in the way that coca ultimately doesn't get, you know, transmitted all around the world. It's when it becomes cocaine that it becomes a more global commodity. You know, if coffee had emerged another way, what might this history have been different? So when you look at the technological element of why these things emerge and why they're prohibited or not, what else pops out at you about all of that?
Well, I mean, you've said a lot there, and I do like your work on regimes. I have to say that as a historian, I was always borrowing from social scientists, and especially you and Peter Andreas, a political scientist I admire very much at Brown. But for example, some of the issues that you're talking about remind me of the earlier work of Wolfgang Schivelbusch, who is, I believe Schivelbusch is still alive, a European thinker. You know, we don't have many of those left these days, who's written books on big subjects for a long time, including speed and locomotives and lights and wars. And one of his most influential books I found was a book that was published in German in the early 80s called, in the English version, it was called Tastes of Paradise, A Social History of Spices, Stimulants, and Intoxicants. Whenever I teach a course about drugs, I actually always begin with Schivelbusch, because it gives you a way of thinking about these shifts and that some of the technologies that are involved in things that he called the intensification or acceleration of the drug experience. So he begins with these imaginary drug experiences of, say, what we call spices today, and through the impact of tobacco and the impact of coffee, up through the impact of opium on European societies. It's a very European. But there you already have these concepts about the acceleration and intensification of drugs. And yes, you'll hear this in everyday conversations. You'll hear, I was in a conversation with somebody yesterday night, who in a hysterical mode said to me, "Oh, but the drugs today are just so much more powerful. The pot kids are smoking today is just doesn't compare to the nickel weed we had when we were kids." So there's always this continuing acceleration, which is, of course, in some ways, and this, I think, Courtright elaborated on this, is in some ways, you know, it has an elective affinity, to use Weber's term, with capitalism. As capitalism speeds up our everyday lives and consumption becomes more and more speeded and needed, especially stimulants become part of everyday lives, the acceleration process takes on a life of its own. So drugs do become more powerful. A great example of that is in alcohol. Alcohol used to be very low grade. You know, you could only get 7 or 8% naturally at most in beers. Most beers around the world were 1 or 2%. And wines you know, 11 or 12%, but come the 17th and 18th century with new distilling techniques in the 19th century, you can make whiskeys and beyond that are just basically all alcohol. And that creates social problems in its wake that, you know, lighter substances did not in themselves entail. So rum and
Paul,
gin.
Paul, I should interrupt. You're reminding me of two things here. One is that I remember when I first read the Shivelbish book, and that book became very popular among my, you know, friends who were all interested in kind of the sociology of drugs and ways of thinking about drugs. But the thing that most stood out for me was the way he talked about spices playing a kind of psychoactive role in the Middle Ages and, you know, 1349, because that was a period when you didn't have coffee. You didn't have tobacco. Only gets to Europe in the 1600s. And spices play a range of roles in terms of, you know, I mean, they cover over the way people smell. They help with food when a food's not very interesting. But also there was a psychoactive element to that. And a lot of the writing about spices sounds like the way people write about psychoactive drugs in more contemporary times.
Well, what I would say about Shivelbush, whether he was doing this consciously or not, is that he was articulating historically what we call today set and setting. That is, the impact of stimulants, let's call them that, or intoxicants, which is today one of the broader terms is coming in, has a lot to do with the environments that we're in, a coffee house or, you know, a gin house, has a lot to do with how we imagine them to be. So the point of starting with paradise was that these new luxury goods of the, you know, late Middle Ages that were coming into Europe were loaded with meanings. And these meanings created sensations in their consumers. And that is very similar to the processes that began to be attached, in his view, to other exotic substances later, like coca. Not coca, but cacao, chocolate, tobacco, coffee, and so on. Mm-hmm. So it is this idea of the kind of what anthropologists and psychologists call the social construction of drugs. That is a kind of a cultural social construction of drugs. And that book is excellent in sort of like introducing that idea without the jargon.
We'll be talking more after we hear this ad.
There's a lot happening these days, but I have just the thing to get you up to speed on what matters without taking too much of your time. The 7 from the Washington Post is a podcast that gives you the 7 most important and interesting stories, and we always try to save room for something fun. You get it all in about 7 minutes or less. I'm Hannah Jewell. I'll get you caught up with the 7 every weekday. So follow the 7 right now.
With dozens of streaming services, box office films, and content to choose from, people are spending over 2.5 years of their lives searching for what to watch. But The Hollywood Reporter brings you THR Charts, one place for you, your family, and friends to find the most watched TV shows and movies every week. THR Charts is a guide to help you spend less time scrolling through platforms so that you can spend more time watching and binging the content everyone is talking about, all supported by data and trusted sources like Nielsen, Comscore, and Paired Analytics. Check out THR Charts on HollywoodReporter.com.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, Berry Lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
Many of our audience will now be familiar with the phrase drug set and setting, but that's a phrase that's really kind of coined by Timothy Leary, the Harvard psychology professor and LSD guru, to describe, you know, drug is one thing that impacts your psychoactive experience, but the other two are the drug. What exactly is the drug and the form in which you're taking it? Is it a stimulant? Is it a downer? Is it a tranquilizer? As well as, are you injecting it or smoking it or eating it or drinking it? And then the setting, which is to some extent what you and the broader culture expect this drug experience to be like. And Leary coins that phrase, I think, in the late 50s, early 60s. Then Andrew Weil, who was my very first guest on Psychoactive, he develops it in his book, The Natural Mind, which is a wonderful book, now 50 years old, about why people and individuals use psychoactive drugs. And then Norman Zinberg, who is the Harvard Medical School professor, develops it in a research study in a book called Drug Set and Setting. So I think you're right in terms of, you know, tracing back those origins to Schivelbusch. That's very true. Now, it's also, of course, the nature of the drug experience, right, that gets, that evolves. So at one point in one of your talks, Paul, so you mentioned the sociologist Howard Becker, who writes a, you know, an article, I think, what's it called? Becoming a marijuana user, effectively learning to become high, and the sort of social constructivist, you know, aspect of the drug experience. Or I think about, you know, Harry Levine, who writes his classic article called The Discovery of Addiction back in 1978, you know, subtitled Changing Conceptions of Habitual Drunkenness in America, and looks at the way those notions of addiction and you know, inebriation shift over time. So just say a little more about that, you know, this social constructivist element in the field of drug history.
I mean, you know, I'm going perilously into social constructionism or social constructivism, as sociologists like to call it. Becker is a fascinating character, by the way, in every, his origins, his musicality. You know, he's still living in Paris, apparently.
No, well, you know, he splits his time between Paris, where he's become a famous sociologist profiled in New Yorker magazine, and living in San Francisco, where he's still working and writing at the age of 94.
It's just incredible. But that article really was a kind of a breakthrough piece.
In the 1950s, he wrote that.
In the 1950s, where he observed, I think he was a University of Chicago graduate student. Everything always goes back to the University of Chicago. And he did it basically a participant ethnography with jazz musicians and their audiences. And those are some of the few people who you could find who were smoking marijuana in the 1950s. And he came up with this thesis that's very similar to what, as you said, Weil brought up later, or made into a broader one, that you had to learn how to use marijuana. You had to learn what effects you could have. Your brain had to kind of be in a group and had to, you know, you could smoke pot and be like Bill Clinton, allegedly, and not get high. Or you could smoke pot and you could get high because you were getting all these cues from the people around you as to how to build that that personal but also interpersonal experience. And that's constructivism, which has a broader history in philosophy and the social sciences in general. You know, in sociology, there is this broader school, about social constructivism that really went mad by the 1980s, where everything became socially constructed, gender, race, blah, blah, blah. In the world of drugs, it has a specific meaning and still is an internal debate as to, you know, what is the biological or chemical input. There are some students of drugs who will still say there's an important biological or chemical input to the drug experience, to those on the other extreme who say there's very little. But it's an important school, vitally important school in animating how people look at drugs in history, because you can begin to wrap your way around how drugs become socialized, how they change over time, the internalization of meanings about drugs, how certain drugs become domesticated, which is something that most people would prefer, that is, used in normal situations, used in ritual situations, used modestly, or on the contrary, used in dangerous and risky ways that endanger not only the individual, but they endanger society. So historians have taken have really bought into most of the constructivist ideas. which really do go, I think, go back to Becker. I was never convinced. I'd like to see that Leary invented the term.
I'm pretty sure it was.
I know
him,
it's attributed to him, but it may be one of those urban legends.
I actually think it's not widely known. In fact, that he originated it. I think he was a very creative intellectual, before his days of going, into the guru area. So it was a powerful notion that I think he applied obviously to his psychedelic use, but applied more broadly. But Paul, I cut you off on another point you were about to make there, which is it was once again talking about the transformation in the technologies around drugs, and you had begun to mention the gin epidemic, right? In the 1600s, when you have the emergence, and I interviewed Ed Slingerland, who wrote that wonderful book about why is it, I think it's called Drunk is the name of it.
Right.
About why does alcohol persist throughout global society, notwithstanding its overwhelming harms? He makes the argument, the dominant argument of the book, is that in fact it added more, the benefits of alcohol consumption in terms of human evolution and civilization exceeded the harms. But then he puts a caveat at the end where he said maybe the emergence of distilled alcohol, first in Asia in, I think, the 13th, 14th century, and then in Europe around the 1600s, maybe changes the calculus, right? Mm-hmm. And that could probably be said, I made the reference before to the cigarette rolling machine, which transforms mm-hmm. tobacco consumption, and the invention of the hypodermic syringe, which transforms the ways that people can take drugs in a very positive way from a medical perspective, but a pretty destructive way from a recreational perspective, right? So technology.
Well, there's another aspect of technologies mm-hmm. as well. Slingerland's book, from an alcohol perspective, is part of a larger set of what is sometimes called deep history, going back before we have, strong archives. It shares a lot with archaeology and, kind of a certain school of anthropology. And there has emerged this thesis in many fields that drugs were really important in early humans, mm-hmm. not just alcohol, but other types of plant-based drugs, mushrooms, psychedelics of all kinds, tobacco, and that they were important in creating a great deal of our socialization in groups. And drugs brought people together. And rather than, for example, there's this thesis that has emerged for understanding civilizations in the Middle East, grain-based civilizations, that the main reason for growing grains in the Middle East in the earliest known findings was to be able to produce beer, because beer is what brought these communities mm-hmm. into small urban areas and created, larger political controls. And so rather than beer being a side effect of a Neolithic revolution, it was the other way around. Alcohol mm-hmm. was a propellant to Neolithic revolutions and the formations of early states. And similar theses have been made about some of the ancient societies of the Americas and psychedelics and tobacco.
Well, Paul, I remember at your keynote address in Mexico City this past June, right, to the Conference of Alcohol and Drug Historians, you talked about that early. You make the point, first of all, that it's the Americas from which the large majority of psychoactive plant substances emerge, right? It's not as much Asia and Africa. And that secondly, that early history, both among small groups and then at some point them becoming more of a tool of the elites. Mm-hmm. Once you begin to get the larger Inca and Aztec, et cetera, empires.
Right. Well, it's a very open area of study among archaeologists and anthropologists, but it's getting more and more attention now. Although I have to say that the notion of psychedelics in the Americas, or whatever we're going to call them, the term changes from time to time, goes back to classic ethnobotanists. I think it was a guy named Winston LeBar who first termed this idea of the American drug complex. And he just did this kind of empirical study, and he found out that something like 80% of what were known of psychoactive alkaloidal substances that were used had their origin somewhere in the Americas, usually in the tropics. So there's a ecological reason for this, but why societies, small scale and then larger scale societies, got so involved. And so it was a topic of tremendous research by ethnobotanists, the most famous of whom you're probably familiar with, who's Richard Evan Schultes.
And whose name has probably been mentioned on more episodes of Psychoactive than almost any other.
Then I won't mention him.
What I appreciated, however, was that you also pointed out that he was, from an American perspective, very pivotal and had a global influence, but that there were other European equivalents who even preceded him in some of these ethnobotanical studies.
Yes, he was not the first ethnobotanist, but he had a tremendous impact because of his position at Harvard. He was somewhat of a maverick. I don't know. He was apparently a Republican. And he held very conservative political views, but he did, you know, he collaborated with Hoffman too in one book later about, but he was a cataloger.
Albert Hoffman, just you got to use full names here with Albert Hoffman, who discovered LSD or synthesized it and then synthesized mescaline as well.
In the 40s. But he was an ethnobotanist who did a lot of firsthand research among indigenous peoples and other peoples in Colombia and in the Amazon. And he had this anthropologist, ethnobotanist idea of drugs neutral. It's something to be studied. It's something to be relativized. All societies use them. We need to know more about this. We need to know about their meanings, their forms of ingestion, their chemistries. And he was a great cataloger of the particularly hallucinogenic plants of the Americas. And he kind of legitimized them.
No, and a powerful influence on Andy Weil and Wade Davis and Dennis McKenna and a whole range of others.
And
also somebody, because he was trying these substances as well. It makes you realize how pathetic in some respects that here you have the federal government, National Institute on Drug Abuse, you know, spending billions of dollars to give out to study drugs to people who are essentially required not to have used those drugs. I mean, it just, you know, let's tie our hands behind our back and trying to make generalizations about the properties of these substances.
Right. But going back to your idea about technology, another thing to take into account are the technologies of smuggling and contraband in the 20th century. And there's a lot of interest in that now, in smuggling cultures and smuggling routes and how drugs become illicit, smuggled goods. And their technology is important too, because, you know, what are the first technologies that are used? They're going to be, you know, people walking through borders with, you know, a few ant, it's called ant smuggling. And then there's going to be the automobile, and then there's going to be the train, and then there's going to be the airplane, and then there's going to be the internet. And you get to a point where the technologies that are supporting the abilities of smugglers and contrabandists to get around a prohibitionist regime, which is taking shape really from the 60s onwards, the technologies are favoring smuggling more than the control thereof.
I mean, Paul, that goes into what some people call the iron law of prohibition, right? Of drugs getting more potent, more compact. You know, probably the scientific article I've most quoted over many episodes of Psychoactive is the piece that Joseph Westermeyer wrote in the Archives of General Psychiatry 50 years ago called The Pro-Heroin Effects of Anti-Opium Laws, and pointed out as you had prohibitions on opium emerging in Southwest and Southeast Asia, the market shifted towards heroin because it was more compact, easier to smuggle, more discreet to consume. If you even look back at 100 years ago in the United States, when we banned opium imports, you begin to have the switch to heroin, right? You can see the same thing happen, more contemporaneously, with the bans on first on pharmaceutical opiates and with heroin, the shift to fentanyl, you know, perhaps the most compact form of opioids we have available, more or less, and now the most deadly. And that's happened in a whole range of other areas as well. I mean, coca to cocaine is, to some extent, that story as well.
Well, coca never traveled very far as a commodity. It really couldn't do that. It didn't stay. It wasn't powerful enough. It didn't have that cultural kind of transmissibility. So it stayed within the Andean region, much like what Courtright argued that there's some regional drugs, but once it was synthesized,
well, actually, Paul, let me interrupt you for a second, because I've just having done recently episodes on kava, the South Pacific substance, and also on khat from the Horn of Africa and Yemen. Yeah. Similarly, like coca, these things do not transport well, so that they would have been and those have remained essentially regional psychoactive plant products, right?
You'd
whereas coca,
you
know, by virtue of being refined and then getting first into Coca-Cola, Van Mariani, the popular Bordeaux wine with a coke infusion, and then more in the broader cocaine markets, is different in that regard, right?
Transportable.
But coffee and tobacco and tea, those all do transport very well.
Very well.
And alcohol, it can be produced anywhere, but also transports very well. Right. So the transportability of different substances appears to make a very significant. I mean, if you ask why didn't kava or khat? I mean, those things might have been more appealing if in a kind of modernized element, if they could have traveled well. It makes you, I mean, I always wonder the question, what would compete effectively with coffee in the contemporary world? And if coca becomes decriminalized in some ways, could it emerge as a competitive product? Or if they figure out with khat or kava, how to turn it into something? Or is it the flavor, the smell, and the taste? And that's why coffee is so preeminent, whereas that's not true of many of these other substances.
Well, we're going to be getting a lot of questions that you hear. A wider variety of caffeinated or pseudo-caffeinated substances like guarana from Brazil or mate from the Southern Cone, they could become minor competitors as global commodities to coffee. But, you know, coffee is coffee. Though there was a problem. Listen, in the 1920s...
By which you mean coffee is coffee because of its wonderful aroma?
It's got everything. It's already established itself in the path dependency since the 16th century as the kind of, you know, primary stimulant of Western societies and others. But, you know, in the 1920s, the League of Nations was worried that there would be a trade in raw caffeine because there were mountains of caffeine that were being stored when they began to make decaffeinated coffee. And they thought that this, you know, this white substance was going to be like the next, drug that was going to be, you know, trafficked across borders. But I don't think the global caffeine trade, never took off as feared, or it's only made it into a few energy drinks that we, unfortunately consume a lot of, today.
Well, Paul, I'm just thinking, if we think in terms of drug biographies, right? I mean, you've sort of done one on cocaine. But if we look, like if coffee, for example, right? I mean, if you look at where it was originally sort of used and then where the major loci of production have been in recent centuries, right? I mean, that's one, like if you take something like tobacco that comes from the Americas, and maybe the same is true of cacao, which becomes chocolate, comes from the Americas and becomes globalized, right? And then those things begin to be produced in many other parts of the world. Coca, maybe the same thing, where you begin to get production in the East Indies, for example, Indonesia, Malaysia. But I'm thinking about when we look at these substances, which are the ones that sort of emerge in one area and that region continues to be the dominant production region throughout centuries, which are the ones where it begins in one region and then another region basically becomes a dominant production place? And which are the ones where it initially starts someplace else and then like coffee or something gets, you know, becomes, you know, disassociated from its original region?
I could give you a whole lecture about the kind of the shifting dynamics of, you know, coffee production and marketing around the world, because it's there's been a lot written about it. And it, but what I would say the most important thing to bear in mind is that these goods were part of the rise of early modern and then modern commercial empires and colonialism. So coffee, you know, what as a plant, most of what we consume as coffee today came from the Horn of Africa. It had across the Arabian Peninsula a kind of coffee culture and spread slowly throughout the Middle East. But it's the rise of European colonialism that shifts the locus of where coffee is going to be important. The Indian Ocean region actually began the whole rise of coffee as a global commodity, but very much under the control of indigenous merchant groups in India and along what we would call the Emirates today. But then later, by the 17th and 18th century, the Dutch and the English and the French are getting involved and displacing. It was a very profitable commodity, and they displace these native merchant networks, and coffee itself as a colonial crop begins to spread to areas where it could be more profitably concentrated by these colonial powers. So the first major area where this amplification of coffee happens, well, first there's the Dutch in Java, which is still why we call coffee Java sometimes, but is the Caribbean and Haiti and the French. They grow, they plantationize coffee in the Caribbean with the slave regime in Saint-Domingue. And then when that's overthrown in the 18th century, coffee begins to spread to another slave regime in Brazil and expands on a global scale in the 19th century in a way that had never been seen before. Very much part of the rise of the informal American sovereignties in the Americas. So the big coffee market that's emerging in the 19th century is between the mass consumption of coffee in the United States, with all the rise of these frontier markets and coffee roasters and AMPs and all of this, and these Brazilian plantations that are multiplying and multiplying, particularly around the Santos, you know, Sao Paulo region. So by the end of the 19th century, Brazil is producing 80 to 90% of the world's coffee, and it's like 100 times more coffee than had been produced at the beginning of the 19th century. And it's become an everyday commodity, democratized in the United States and beginning to become democratized in Europe as well. And really, you know, at that point has transformed the way we live.
And why does Brazil lose that role then in the 20th century?
Brazil still has an important role in the history of coffee. But to give you the short answer of that, the commodity historian and myself will tell you this, is that Brazil continued to be very important along with Colombia and Central America dominating world coffee markets until the 1980s. And something happened at the end of the 1980s that changed the way coffee was marketed globally. And that was the end of the Cold War. At the end of the Cold War, the International Coffee Agreement, which was a way that the United States thought that it was containing revolution in the tropical belts of the Americas and Africa and Southeast Asia, because so many millions of coffee peasants depended on the price of coffee being, you know, stable, so they wouldn't become communists. The Americans withdrew all their support from the International Coffee Agreement, and so coffee began to fluctuate in price in ways that was unimaginable during the Cold War. And that's led to the rise of these new coffee producers. Vietnam is one of the largest coffee producers in the world now, ironically. Mm-hmm. But also African countries. The coffee belt has sort of spread throughout the globe there, you know, more in response to market mechanisms than this politicized market that had been in the mercantilist market that had been in the 20th century.
Let's take a break here and go to an ad.
There's a lot happening these days, but I have just the thing to get you up to speed on what matters without taking too much of your time. The 7 from the Washington Post is a podcast that gives you the 7 most important and interesting stories, and we always try to save room for something fun. You get it all in about 7 minutes or less. I'm Hannah Jewell. I'll get you caught up with the 7 every weekday. So follow the 7 right now.
With dozens of streaming services, box office films, and content to choose from, people are spending over 2.5 years of their lives searching for what to watch. But The Hollywood Reporter brings you THR Charts, one place for you, your family, and friends to find the most watched TV shows and movies every week. THR Charts is a guide to help you spend less time scrolling through platforms so that you can spend more time watching and binging the content everyone is talking about, all supported by data and trusted sources like Nielsen, Comscore, and Paired Analytics. Check out THR Charts on HollywoodReporter.com.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today.
Health Aid kombucha.
Now, Paul, to compare and contrast to other drugs, coca is so identified with the Andean region of Latin America, but there's a point at which what the Dutch take it to East Asia, and that emerges
yes.
as what an even, I don't know, was it an even more dominant exporter for some years than,
yes.
than Latin America?
Yeah.
What's the quick version of that story about how that comes
about?
Well,
the quick version of that is that it is around 1900, coca is emerging along with cocaine. You know, as a sizable, important new drug. It was used in drinks. It was used in medicines. Cocaine was a medical commodity of great importance, particularly in surgery. It was beginning to be, there were beginning to be some strong reservations about its wider use. And so European imperial powers, including the British, the French, the Dutch, and the Germans, began experimenting with their own coca plantations. They all wanted to see if in their colonies, you know, this was the era of the imperialist grab, particularly in Africa, in their own colonies, whether or not they could make a killing on, you know, a wide variety of commodities and drug substances. The British did successfully grow coca in India and Sri Lanka. But the one that really took off was the Dutch. And there was a long history behind this. Dutch were consummate commercial imperialists, and their botanical gardens were always experimenting with new commodities. And they started setting up in Java and Sumatra kind of model plantations for coca. And the coca plantations there were much more cost effective than they were in the Andes, where it was generally a kind of a chaotic peasant run crop. The way we think of today, coffee, say, in a smallholder place like Colombia. And instead, there were these massive plantations, very high productivity, linked to scientific processes and linked to a kind of a mercantilist policy of the Dutch state, which was to dominate the cocaine markets of Europe. And so the Dutch set up this national cocaine factory, and it was in the middle of Amsterdam. And all this, you know, East Asian coca came up there in the teens and through the 1920s, was made into cocaine, spread around Europe. There was so much of it being produced in Holland that it was infiltrating sort of in a gray zone into Asian markets as well as a kind of an illicit drug. And so it was successful.
But there's never any real emergence of domestic consumption of coca cocaine in these other parts
of
the world.
Not very
right?
much that we can, you know, that we can point mm-hmm. to. Not in Indonesia, in what we call today Indonesia. There are people who are studying that in the case of India, whether or not that happened in the case of India or not, but really not. Mm-hmm. No. And what's interesting is that the Dutch actually got rid of most of their cocaine and coca voluntarily. It was one of the few examples of this happening. And that is when they were, it has to do with some very complex politics of the League of Nations and trying to limit drugs in the 1920s and 1930s. And the Dutch decided that the cocaine business was just not
yeah.
that important to them. What was more important was getting concessions about their opiate farming, as it was called, in Southeast Asia. So they downgraded the cocaine colonialism that they had. The Japanese had done something very similar, by the way, with Formosa, what we call today Taiwan, developed a very high-grade, modernistic cocaine industry based on Formosan-colonized coca that was some of the largest pharmaceutical companies in Japan were involved in this.
So, Paul, switching subjects here, you know, on the criminalization and evolution of prohibition regimes, right? I mean, both, I don't just mean global regimes, but even prohibition laws. But when we look at these prohibitions from a more global perspective, is it right to put it all on the U.S. and on the West as being the driving force for all of these things? Or in fact, are there varied traditions of prohibitionism throughout the world going back centuries, if not millennia?
So you've asked a good question. What is it that makes 20th century global prohibition your term? There are some historians who try to contest that we never really had full global prohibition. What is it that makes it different? One of the things in my mind that makes it different is as part of this whole thing that, you know, what sociologists like Scott would call high modernism, this idea that the state can absolutely try to control individual behavior, restructure society according to, you know, a set of ideal parameters. And we've seen that most of those ideas, you know, have failed, whether it be the Soviet Union or drug prohibition. They fall into kind of overambitious, you know, state-led projects. And I think a lot of people who are looking at drugs are now, and alcohol as well, alcohol prohibition. You said that you had McGurr on here. You know, her thesis is that alcohol prohibition in the United States was integral to the process of modern, you know, federal state building in the United mm-hmm. States. And I think a lot of people who look at drugs now are interested in its intersection with processes like state building and wars. But whether or not, is it always from the center? Is it that has been one of the most contested issues in recent years? And I'll just give you an example of one of the most interesting books on this subject, which is Isaac Campos, a very good colleague of mine, published a book about a decade ago called Homegrown Marijuana and the Origins of Mexico's War on Drugs. What he argues in here is that by the 19th century, first of all, marijuana, cannabis is not indigenous to Mexico, but it was one of these drugs that gets adopted and becomes indigenized during the 19th century, mostly by non-indigenous peoples, mestizo peoples in Mexico. But by the late 19th century, becomes very much the discourses around marijuana become very frightening to Mexican elites. Marijuana is something that poor, desperate, violent people use. And there's this idea of marijuana leading to madness, an idea that comes and goes every 10 years or so, you know, even now. And so marijuana madness, you know, what was translated in the United States as reefer madness, according to Campos, is really a conception that's made in its modern form in Mexico. And mm-hmm. Mexico's drug laws by 1917 are beginning the prohibition of marijuana in Mexico. And so he, in the end, it's only suggestive, but he suggests that what happens in the United States, rather than racism against Mexican Americans, he suggests it was a different type of flow. Mexico's prohibitionist fears and anxieties about marijuana become adopted by physicians and politicians in the United States in the 1930s and are then amplified by the kind of Anslinger type of campaign. Mm-hmm. So in Campos's idea, you know, so there's nothing that's American about this. It can have origins in other places as well.
So Paul, just to like tangent off of this, one point you also make in your writing is that cannabis is paradoxically the least studied of the major world drugs.
Yes.
Why do you think that is?
Oh, yeah. Well, I think that is actually being remedied now. I think there are a lot of people who are doing dissertations, serious dissertations. I had one in my own department about the Caribbean recently, but I have a pretty good thesis as to why. When drug history began, it really began with the hard drugs, right? It began with those studies that we mentioned earlier about opiates. And then people began to study cocaine. And for some reason, marijuana just remained completely out of the scope of people who were doing serious studies. And why was that? Well, I think in part, it was the image problem. Marijuana was just too much of a stoner's drug. It was something that we assumed we knew about. It was too easy. It wasn't something that was befit a serious type of study. It was kind of the Cheech and Chong of drug history. But that has begun to shift. I mean, there are very serious studies that are emerging, and they're changing a lot of ideas about the global spread of cannabis, about the global impact, about
I mean, Paul, I was struck by the amount that's coming out about cannabis in Africa. I mean, just before a recent trip I took to Nigeria and Sierra Leone, I was doing some background reading, and there's serious scholarship about cannabis in South Africa and West Africa or parts other parts. So
Because it was always assumed that, for example, that there was even a synthesis by Chris Duval, the African roots of marijuana came out just a few years ago, and has had a tremendous impact on the field. And he argues that Africa was an important way station in the globalization and dissemination of marijuana to the Americas and elsewhere, that it's this completely hidden history of very, very rapid African innovation and use of different forms of cannabis, including, and this might shock you, the invention of the bong. In East Africa. But there's been a lot about Duval's book that other historians who work on cannabis have said, well, I don't know if that linguistic argument works that well, or there's not enough research on this. But I think cannabis's time has come now for serious research, given that it stopped being such a marginal topic. I mean, you know, for years, the only source that people had was the marijuana conviction, those types of works that were written very much in haste in the early 70s in order to, you know, have a counter critique to.
And for our listeners, that's The Marijuana Conviction by Richard Bonney and Whitebread. Richard Bonney having been the deputy director of the Nixon Schaefer Commission 50 years ago and still a professor teaching at the University of Virginia Law School. So, Paul, since we're almost out of time, last question here. When we look at the major lacunae in drug history studies these days, I mean, we see more stuff emerging on synthetic drugs, for example, and how important that is. Raises important questions about, you know, as more and more drugs can be produced synthetically at lower costs and getting them from their plant origins, that's going to represent a major evolution. But the thing that struck me, in part because of my own personal role in all of this over the last 30 years, my own evolution, is it still seems that I cannot think of a serious, really substantive, comprehensive history of U.S. drug policy from the 1970s to the present, in terms of looking at the war on drugs, in terms of looking at the congressional politics, in terms of looking at White House policy of people going into, you know, doing FOIA requests and doing archival research. I don't know if you can think of anything, I mean, substantial. And I wonder, you know, is this in the works, or are there good reasons why this hasn't happened as yet?
You know, that's a great question. You know, somebody else brought that up with me recently. And, you know, sometimes in academic fields, there are some questions that are so big that they just remain there as holes because people assume it's been done and it hasn't been done. And you're right. There have been people who've worked a lot on the mid-century and U.S. drug policies, like the book by Catherine Friedel. There's more and more work in kind of those historical archives, but I don't think that there's an overarching history of the U.S. war on drugs. In part, it's because, like a lot of historical questions, people are waiting to see how it turned out. How does the story end? Now that we see that the story is ending in a way that was not predicted by its constructors in the 1950s through 70s, and is falling apart and losing all consensus and losing global consensus as well. For example, we have no partners to wage a war on drugs left in Latin America. That's an important example. I think, it's time. And I've heard of people, for example, a colleague of mine in Britain who worked on Mexico wants to write a history of the DEA in this whole period and their involvements. But he says it's very difficult given the kind of the hiding or hoarding of documents. So it's very difficult to do that type of work.
Exactly.
And so we're left with works that were written a long time ago, like Epstein's Agency of Fear, written in the moment with a kind of ideological weight to them?
No, that was an important book about the Nixon era, but he was a journalist. Well, listen, Paul, we are basically out of time. I hope we've left a lot of dangling questions and half-completed answers, which I hope we'll take up in future seasons of Psychoactive, if in fact we succeed in that. But I'm very grateful for you taking the time to talk with me and my listeners on Psychoactive about the global history of drugs. So thank you very much.
Happy to be part of this. And thank you for the invite.
Okay, Paul, and I'll be following up offline so we can schedule our next bike ride around Brooklyn.
Okay.
If you're enjoying Psychoactive, please tell your friends about it. Or you can write us a review at Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. We love to hear from our listeners. If you'd like to share your own stories, comments, and ideas, then leave us a message at 1-833-779-2460. That's 833-PSYCHO-0. Or you can email us at psychoactive@protozoa.com or find me on Twitter at Ethan Nadelman. You can also find contact information in our show notes. Psychoactive is a production of iHeartRadio and Protozoa Pictures. It's hosted by me, Ethan Nadelman. It's produced by Noam Osband and Josh Thane. The executive producers are Dylan Golden, Ari Handel, Elizabeth Giesis, and Darren Aronofsky from Protozoa Pictures, Alex Williams and Matt Frederick from iHeartRadio, and me, Ethan Nadelman. Our music is by Ari Belusian, and a special thanks to Avivit Bar-Yosef, Bianca Grimshaw, and Robert Beebe. Next week, I'll be talking with Charlie Wininger, a New York psychotherapist and author of Listening to Ecstasy, as well as his wife, Shelley Wininger, about healthy aging and sexuality with MDMA and marijuana.
MDMA helped me get in touch with my 8-year-old, my 18-year-old, my 28-year-old. And I can do that when I'm sober, because my inner child or my inner 18-year-old or my inner 30-year-old has things to tell me and things to remind me of. And that this vitality and spontaneity that I had then is still available to me.
Subscribe to Psychoactive now so you don't miss it.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today.
Health Aid kombucha.
With dozens of streaming services, box office films, and content to choose from, people are spending over 2.5 years of their lives searching for what to watch. But The Hollywood Reporter brings you THR Charts, one place for you, your family, and friends to find the most watched TV shows and movies every week. THR Charts is a guide to help you spend less time scrolling through platforms so that you can spend more time watching and binging the content everyone is talking about, all supported by data and trusted sources like Nielsen, Comscore, and Paired Analytics. Check out THR Charts on HollywoodReporter.com.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.